Hello, and welcome to another episode of Endeavors. On today's show, I speak with actress Sonia Smits and writer-director Evan Reese. That's coming up on Endeavors. Well, hello there. Happy Friday and welcome to another episode of Endeavors. This will probably be the last show of the year. I am officially on holiday in Germany and Austria, and I'm trying to get a few life decisions sorted out and work on some writing and just trying to breathe a little bit. I have some things lined up for the new year, but this will most likely be the last episode until January 2024. But what an episode to end on. We have two great Canadian filmmakers, Sonia Smits and Evan Reese. And you may know Sonia from her long-time role on the iconic Canadian television show Street Legal, where she won a Gemini Award for Best Actress in a continuing leading dramatic role and received another nomination for the same category. She was also on The Diviners, where she received another Gemini nomination, as well as Traitors as well. She's also been nominated for two Genie Awards for her roles in the films Videodrome and That's My Baby, and has also appeared in the 2003 film Owning Mahoney opposite Philip Seymour Hoffman, Minnie Driver, John Hurt, and of course the great Canadian actor Maury Chaykin. Her other television appearances include on Mary Kills People, Murdoch Mysteries, American Gods, The Best Laid Plans, Rent-A-Goalie, Odyssey 5, and Made in Canada. Her new film is Better Days, and it is out on VOD and digital as of December 8th. This is my conversation with Sonia Smits. Sonia, hello. How are you today?
Hello, Dan.
Hi, sorry. There's a bit of a delay on my end. I apologize.
That's okay.
You have a new film out, Better Days, and it's a very interesting premise. What first attracted you to the role of Kate?
Because there are so few roles written that are at all interesting for women of my mature vintage, you know, that attracted me because it was smart writing and also, I guess the topic of where she's at in her life, which is a profound change and unexpected change because of the death of her husband. I'm sort of at the point in my life too that things are, you know, less predictable. That's more of a reality of possibilities, and so that's an interesting thing to explore. Yeah.
You know, the film deals with grief. How can art help us heal in that sense? How do you find that it can?
Well, I'm hoping that when you do something like this film, Better Days, that it is helpful to people. I think some it would be to others, maybe not, because maybe their take in it on it isn't the same thing as, say, Jones the writers take and or and the characters take on it, because but I think seeing things, I mean, I watched it with a friend of mine whose was husband died maybe about 3 or 4 years ago, and there she just as she said, I kept thinking about it, just it won't go, leave out of my mind. It's so much there. And she's one of those people that her fellow friends say she hasn't gotten over her husband. She should be over him by now. And this film is good because it's like, no, who says who? Like, at what point are you supposed to be like, you know, she says, what's the appropriate amount of grief? Well, is there appropriate amount of grief? And she also admitted to, you know, screaming in the woods, which is what my character does. So maybe she feels less crazy for doing that. You know, and also her kids are bugging her to sell this and sell that. And she's going, what? I don't want to. And so Joan hit on so many truths. So for if that's the one person I know, my friend, I'm sure there are other people that will say, I can relate to that and I can relate to that. You know, whether it's the pressure from your offspring saying, come on, move on. This is, or your friend saying, that's enough time. And you're going, says who? So I think hopefully that can be helpful to someone to say, okay, number one, I'm not crazy. Someone else, you know, feels this way, and screw it, I'll do it the way I want to do it.
How much of yourself would you say comes into a role like this? How much of Sonya is in Kate?
Well, I think, I mean, you're acting as soon as you step on a set, because there's lights and there's people and there's, you know, but I know when Joan asked me to do this, she wanted me to do it. Like, she wrote it like with me in mind. So obviously whatever her idea of me is, you know, is what was right for this character. So I basically, well, how would I react? It wasn't like I was had to create someone that's far away from my experience. So I could just use whatever my take would be on how I would do it,
Having
right?
a character written for you, what sort of confidence does that give you as a performer? Because it's not every day that that happens.
No. No, not at all. It gives you a lot of confidence. It's also a lot of responsibility, because you think, well, geez, you know, really? It is a lot of responsibility. But then ultimately, I guess, embracing it and saying that there's a freedom. So in other words, I really can't do anything wrong, because it's me. And it's such a kind of crazy role, because she kind of goes all over the map and is kind of, you know, pretty eccentric in many ways, and goofy in many ways, and serious in many ways. So it gave me a lot of latitude, which was wonderful. You don't often get that. It's like I had whatever range, you know, I wanted to go. You know, it was there, it was wide open.
Speaking of Malleable, how malleable was the script? Was everything set in stone when you got there, or did you and Joan kind of work together a little bit to flesh things out?
Joan started out, her first thing is writing. She was a novelist and a screenplayer, sc a screenwriter. So she wrote the screenplay, and it was very text heavy, you know, very text heavy, because of all that address to camera and direct address to camera and all of that. So it was very, very a lot of words in it, not a lot of actions, mostly a lot of words. But it was interesting, and I thought, oh my God, I have to really work on that, because it was a small budget, so you didn't have a lot of time, so you kind of had to hit the ground running and kind of know what you're doing and kind of go for it, right? Or have an idea of what you're doing and go for it. But on the other hand, surprisingly enough, Joan, who was a writer, was also the director. But she said, that's director. She said, if it's not working, just change it. It's like, what are you talking about? If it's not working, just change it. Or if you want to add in something, go ahead. It's like, what? I spent a couple of months just learning this, and I grew up in the theater, and the theater is like the word is sacrosanct. So it was kind of an interesting kind of situation. I mean, pretty well, that's like all Joan's words with little, maybe tiny little, little adjustments. But in a way, it was sort of nice as a director. So I had to say, okay, as long as I kind of go for the meat of it, the I's and the T's don't have to be perfect,
Your character in the film forms a friendship with three teenagers. And intergenerational friendships maybe aren't as foreign as they used to be. But I'm curious how much of your sort of getting to know each other on set as co-workers imitated the characters getting to know each other in the story.
I think we just played. We were ready to play a bit, It was like, okay, I mean, obviously I'm the veteran, right? So there was that, but the actors were young and very like sweet and kind of open, and so we just played, it was nice.
What sort of conversations happened about life? Like, did you teach them anything? Did you give them any advice? Did they teach you anything about perspective or how they maybe look at the world, anything like that?
God, the philosophical. It was COVID, man.
Fair enough.
We're all just trying to stay alive.
Fair enough, fair enough.
They were really, really, really lovely, but it was, they were, I think it, a lot of them, it was like pretty new to the process, so it was kind of, a learning experience for them too, It was nice though to have that kind of freshness come into the scenes,
What does someone who is less seasoned bring to a performance that maybe a more veteran performer doesn't or can't?
I think there's sort of just a, for lack of a better word, a purity or a simplicity that they kind of bring to it. Plus, they're beautiful. You look at them, you go, oh, you're so beautiful. Look at your eyes. Look at your skin. They're so beautiful.
You mentioned off the top that it's hard because there aren't as many roles for women when they reach a certain age as men, especially in film. I mean theater is its own thing, but even that's not great. But film especially. How far do you think we've come in the last, I don't know, half a decade or so in leveling that out a little bit, and where do you see it going?
Well, I would love to say it's all fabulous, but it still is nowhere near where. I'm not even talking about equality. I think just actually conceiving that a mature woman can actually be of interest to an audience is still, you, I think, have to fight for that concept, that what we're going through or what our approach on life is actually of interest, I think is still, And then you do something like the people say, oh, that was really good, or that was really interesting. Yeah. But it's like, is that the first thing that's going to spring to mind? No. When people are pitching ideas or whatever it is, right? In the medium, right? Or it's or it's jokes,
Yeah.
old lady jokes.
And there is, a market for it, and there are a lot of good stories to tell, but where do you think the hesitancy lies? Is it just that there's not enough people who create these stories or know how to create these stories?
Well, oh my God, that's a whole philosophical societal conversation is. I mean, we love youth, right? We're a youth-oriented society, right? And then you do a film about grief and death, and people kind of looking at like, how much time do I have left? It's like, oh no, we're not even supposed to go there, right? No, we're all supposed to be like, hey, yes, isn't it? Aren't I all vibrant and cool and hip? It's like, guess what? It's coming, you know? Like in this film where the kid says, you'll get there, and it's like, yeah, but what do you got to look forward to, you know? I mean, that's one very bleak take, you know, you're sitting in a chair in your diapers, you know. So, you know, that's a bummer. But you know, if we all live long enough, that's what's coming. So maybe we need to, you know, be a little braver about exploring that. And I don't know, maybe having some laughs about it
I
too.
mean, does working on a film like this and, you know, touching on a subject matter such as grief, does it make you think about mortality maybe more so or in a different way than you might have before?
I've been thinking about this subject for a while, like a number of years. You know, I have parents who, you know, died, and they both died at home. I brought them home. And I feel that just as a society, it's a subject that it's very taboo. We really don't want to be near it. You put them in a home or you know, somewhere else out of sight, and people don't visit because it's kind of awkward because who wants to see that? As we, and I think it's been a sort of a pet peeve of mine going, you know, it's part of life and we keep avoiding this, you know, and there's so much room for improvement with how we approach different things. Phases of life. It's easy to be happy about a baby, you know, or a toddler, like they're so cute and so whatever. But, you know, at a certain point, do we stop being sort of interested or sympathetic to people beyond a certain age because they kind of are a little scary or they're a little wrinkly or they're a little frail or they're deaf or they're like, you know, and we kind of start avoiding that, let alone the really far end of things. And I don't know. I don't know if that's a North American more Western culture, or like traveling like in Sicily this fall, and a lot of the old towns, the hilltop towns, it's just all old people in the towns because all the young people have left. But it's kind of like they're ruling the town, like they're sitting on the town squares and they're doing their thing. It's like it's their hood, you know, they're doing their thing. So I just think as a general topic, I think it would make our lives better if we actually had more stories and exploration of humanizing, quite frankly, older people. You know, I talked to someone who was, you know, a nurse in a seniors like a care home. I said, "What was the big learning thing when you switched to geriatric care?" And she said, "Really?" And then she was the head of nursing there. She went, "The amount of sex." It's like, what? Really? She said, yeah. And there's jealousies and there's rivalries going on. She said, yeah, you have to be careful because, you know.
Yeah.
It's like, and we think, oh no, that's done. But no, you know, it's not just Kim Kardashian, you know, or whoever, right? But so there's a whole lives going on that we just don't want to know about, right?
Know, given the subject matter of this film, and you know, you sort of shot it in the midst of COVID, what did you do to kind of maybe not let the mood sag too much or a little, and you know, try to keep things relatively light.
Don't know. I think you just do the work. You know, really, that's all you had the kind of energy for. Because it's weird, you were shooting during COVID, you don't even see cast, you know, the crew's faces
Right.
because they're all covered up. It's a very odd. You know, so trying to look for a connection, which the only connection you can really have, because the people who aren't masked are the actors. You can't connect really with the crew because they're you can't see them.
Do you feel like the pandemic has changed the industry to some extent?
I wouldn't be the one actually to be able to answer that. I don't really know. I don't really know. Except that certainly as consumers, we sure consumed a lot more on our screens than we were all like, all of us absorbing it a lot. So our interaction is much more with the screen than it was before, and right with our home screens.
Was there a favorite scene or moment that you had during the film that you just, really liked, working that day, or you really liked how it turned out?
Don't know if I can pull out a certain scene. I mean, I loved when I got to act with the other actors because I did a lot of like solo stuff, right? So like with Alex, who played my best friend, well, not really my best friend, but she thought she was my best friend. Just to have that interaction was nice, or with the young people, or with my kids, because I was doing a lot of stuff that was solo. So I enjoyed. I like the give and take when there's another actor.
Working solo on camera is, I think, in a way, much more challenging than being solo on stage. How would you compare those two situations? And were you able to draw on your theater background at all for when you had to be the only person on camera?
Oh yeah, I think starting the theater was very beneficial because in a way, just the way the style of this shoot happened, it's sort of like when you went on set, it was like opening night. You almost, you'd had the conversations with the director, with the writer, Joan. You'd prep for like a long time on your own, and then you kind of had to go in and like opening night, like you were going on stage for the first time, because there wasn't a lot of time or space to not a lot of rehearsal process, and just because the nature of the beast, you had kind of had to hit it running. So yeah, I kind of treated it like, in a way, like you're doing your rehearsing and then you show up and it's opening night. Yeah.
I was going to say, especially since it is sort of a very, it's very dialogue, heavy in a lot of ways. And so did you look at memorizing the dialogue like you would if you're doing theater? Did you bring in a lot of your maybe theater practices in terms of the rehearsal process or memorization, just because it is sort of written that way?
Definitely. Yeah. And like obviously like the on air, the direct address to camera, that was all shot like, in process from beginning to end type of thing, right? So yeah, and that was a few months after we finished shooting, right? So yeah. So that
I
was like a monologue, right? Only broken up to
yeah.
yeah.
Well, it's funny. I think I heard Ben Kingsley once say that the camera is allergic to acting. When you have a big monologue, how different is it knowing that there's, not just an audience, but an island that you really have to keep. Does it change your internal focus at all, if that makes sense?
I guess I'm not sure. I just for me, and I think the way for me the sense of the film was is someone actually the character actually trying to figure it out, like is really trying to figure it out. And even when she's talking to the camera, it's like you don't have the answers, but you're thinking it through and trying to figure it out. So just that process. It's not, I'm going to tell you what it is. It's the figuring out process, which is maybe a little different than other things. It's like you haven't arrived at a point. You're not saying this is what it is. You're going to, I don't know, but you're still trying to figure it out.
Which is interesting
For me,
because,
that's what that.
and I find that really interesting because as a performer, you sort of have to go in having already figured out your process in a lot of way. So how do you figure out a process for somebody who's trying to figure out a process.
I don't know. Now you're making it complicated.
Am I overanalyzing things too much a little
We're
bit?
analyzing. I think you're just trying to figure it
Yeah, fair, fair.
out. Yeah. Yeah. No easy answers for sure. There aren't any way in life, are there?
Exactly, right? It's which I think is what makes this film so great is that it is sort of very true to life, in a lot of ways. Are for you are the best films kind of based in realism and reality, even though we go to them to escape sometimes?
You mean as an actor or as a viewer?
Ooh. Yeah. I mean, I suppose, like, as a performer, as somebody who is telling this story, do you find it easier if it's something that's based in
I find it easier
reality?
if obviously it has to be grounded in something I can relate to, you know,
Right.
that I have some understanding and sympathy for. But there have been times in my life where I have done roles that I don't quite understand what the film is about, but it's like it's very cool and I will kind of be a part of this, but I really don't quite understand the whole thing, but I'll play my part in it.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's
Yeah.
and then in hindsight you go, oh, that's what that meant, you know?
Yeah, once you see it all together, you're like, "Oh yeah,
Yeah,
that makes
yeah,
sense."
yeah, yeah, yeah. There have been, and that's okay. But then, in that case, you really have to trust the director or the filmmaker that they know, you know, what
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
about and what they're doing, because otherwise, it'll be a mess, right?
Trust the process, they say, right? Is there something that you want audiences to take away when they see this film?
I guess I hope that they take away some, I don't know, permission or relief in going, hey, it's okay to be as crazy as you want, or as to kind of go through these processes of loss, which we all have in our lives, however it works for you. And stop having to please anybody else or fit what that is. There's a whole myriad of ways of going through that, and we'll maybe give them some comfort that there is a way through it eventually, but there's not a right way,
Right.
you know? And that's really what it is. Yeah, I guess for me, there's not a right way. And also, actually, in a horrible times and difficult times, it's funny too. Like sometimes it's just ridiculous.
Yeah.
I mean, I think of some things in real life that, like, my dad in my house, and it's like we're trying to get him on the jamming onto the thing. Like it was like a bad comedy because the hearse door wouldn't open, and we're ramming the thing, and it's like sister and I were in hysterics. Giggling. It was a sad, you know, and there is that in life. Sometimes the worst moments are also pretty friggin' funny, you know.
Absolutely, absolutely. We've talked about a lot is how, la laughter can be the best, thing. The film is Better Days, and when can we see it out in theaters in Canada?
I think had a short theatrical release, but I think it's going to go out, which the other person will know more than me, on video on demand or whatever those streaming services
Right.
anywhere
Yes.
in the United States and Canada. I'm not sure right now about
I think it's
Britain, which is where you are now, right? Okay.
just yeah. See, I'm in the yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, December 5th. I'm being informed.
Yeah. Yeah. Video on demand and whatever those streaming services are. Yeah.
It is out now on
Yeah.
Video On Demand. Better days.
Yeah.
Sonia Smits, thanks so much for your time today.
Okay. Take care.
Cheers.
Okay. Bye.
'Again, that was my conversation with actress Sonia Smits. Her new film, Better Days, is available now on digital and on demand. Well, from a film about the modern age and sort of modern relationships, if you will, we go back in time to Toronto 1989, where a powerful new street drug, Pearl, is making people do strange things. Such is one of the plot lines in the satirical, dark comedy, action, drama, Going In, written, directed, and starring Evan Reese. This film initially started as a short film for Evan back in the mid-2010s. And it's been a labor of love to get the feature film made and released. And so I talked to him about, you know, going from a short film to a feature, directing yourself, and how Toronto deserves to be its own character in a story. This is my conversation with Evan Reese.
I'm good. How you doing?
Pretty good. Now, my neighbors are playing music. Let me know if it picks up.
I can't hear any. I can't hear anything. So,
okay,
we're good.
That's why I've got my headphones on. I just wouldn't want it to come through.
Yeah, for sure. Evan Reese, how you doing, my man? You good?
Great.
Yeah. You have a new film, Going In. Now, I know this was adapted from a short film of yours. Was it always the plan to turn it into a feature?
Yeah, always. So the short film wasn't really, I mean, it was a standalone thing, but it was more so a proof of concept, which is like, hey, we've got this concept, we can prove that we can do it, we want to raise money to make it a full length. So yeah, it was always the case. So, you know, narratively, the short was more so just like, there was no real start and ending. It was more like a showcase.
Right.
And in doing so, showing like, hey, this is what we would do if we could make a feature.
And how does that process overall work? Because I know the short was about, what, 4 or 5 years ago now. So obviously, you know, some time has passed, but just the process from getting it from the short to the feature.
It was longer than 4 or 5 years ago, unfortunately. We released that in 2016. So that was basically, you know, we made it to pair with a crowdfunding. We did an Indiegogo and it was a display. We had a campaign video just being like, hey, like, look what we can do and da da da. And kind of showing people a little taste, a little snippet. Little did we know that the main feature would be made for not much money either. So we were able to raise about 40 grand. We got some other investments, and there was about 2 years since we made the proof of concept to when we shot the feature. And then that time, thematically and tonally, I mean, the short was very buddy cop, very comedy based, almost a parody of 80s movies. Whereas within that time, once I realized we didn't have much money to make this like massive blockbuster type spectacle that it became more character based. So based on budget, it became more tonally, more of a neo-noir, kind of more of a an experimental, I guess, stab at the 80s homage than a straight up like parody of it.
What made you want to set a film in the 80s? I mean, it's interesting that the 80s have become kind of retro now, in a lot of ways, but 1989 specifically, what was it about that time that said this is going to make for a good story?
Yeah, well, it's funny you mentioned that when we shot the short film, we shot it before the first season of Stranger Things even came out. So, like you said, retro is very popular right now and very in vogue. But we were kind of at the forefront of it, of being like, hey, like I've always had an affinity for 80s movies. And for this one, it was like, hey, a ton of movies are shot and filmed in Toronto, but they're not really set here. And a lot in the 80s as well, you know, the city often masquerades as Chicago or New York City, but it's never actually been its own thing. And so, you know, you can look to early David Cronenberg, where it's like, yes, Videodrome was set here, but then even things later on, The Fly, Scanners, they were shot here, but they were never actually set in this Toronto. So it was cool for me to kind of make Toronto this almost like a low-key a character in this film, because it has its own look. You know, we shot at local institutions, things of that nature, where it's like, should this exist? Should this fictitious drug take over the city in the late 80s, when the world where, you know, PSAs are all over the airways. You know, it was really a hearkening back, but also we really tried to emulate movies from that era.
How easy was it to 80s up the locations? I mean, obviously a lot of that c comes in post, but was there any locations that just existed as they were in the 80s?
For sure. Yeah, we shot a lot of local institutions, like, you know, certain burger spots or pizza spots that kind of haven't changed their decor. A lot of old loft apartments that even in the 5 years that we've shot it have been torn down. So we really tried to shoot in locations that did exist back then and were like landmarks. So, you know, we shot a big scene at the Great Hall in Toronto, which has been there for over 100 years. Theoretically, that could have existed then. So it was tough, but it was just planning. Like, honestly, if we were to shoot something, we couldn't do huge, massive sets because there would obviously be signs of new technology, there'd be cars, but there was certain instances where, you know, up in the junction, we were able to shut down a street and bring in 80s cars and kind of set them there and shoot at strategic angles where you wouldn't be able to tell, oh, hey, this is modern day. And then, of course, like you mentioned, we did employ some other tactics where it's like, here's the Toronto skyline. But we tastefully VFX'd out all the ugly condos. So it looks like it could have been 1989. Like, you know, the Sky Dome was just built, just opened in fall of 1989. So that was like, you know, it's important, at least for me, to show that what it looked like at the time and at least try and, like, you know, bring people into it where it's like, okay, I know what we're talking about now.
Can I ask about the hair? Because your hair is very 80s, and you know, I still see some remnants of it. So obviously it was real or mostly real and not a wig. But how important is something like that for you in terms of defining the character?
I think it's very essential. I think, you know, for a genre movie or a film like this, it's paramount that the characters act with conviction. So that's all the way down from, you know, the clothing to the underwear to the hair to witticisms and how you talk to the editing process. There's so many little things, so much minutia that happened in movies from that era that don't happen now. So that, like I mentioned, it's sentence structure, it's how it's edited, it's the lighting techniques, it's the shooting techniques. You know, we didn't use crazy camera techniques that didn't exist back then. So it was definitely all the way through, at least intentionally, the best that we could of being like, you know what, how would they have shot this back then? Within reason, like we made this movie for no money, we made it for $80,000. So that almost helped us in a way because we didn't want to get too crazy or too advanced in the way we shot something. And to me, that was never the point. You know, a lot of 80s movies, even the aforementioned Stranger Things, it looks way too perfect. It's 8K, everything is ultra, ultra high definition. So we wanted to go the other way where it's the raw grittiness, it's the imperfections. And that's, you know, we shot it with old 70s anamorphic lenses to kind of allow that look and the aesthetic to almost be a part of the character. And that plays in with the soundtrack as well, you know, very analog, old arpeggio synths, Tangerine Dream style. Ideally, it was a full package from, like you said, from the look, from the acting, from the sound. Everything was ideally a contained package.
You mentioned $80,000, and sometimes a byproduct of that is everyone doing multiple roles. And I know you wrote, directed, and acted in it. And I know you did the same in your short. Was that always going to be the case, or was that just a product of budget?
For this project, it was always going to be the case. I have written and directed other things where I haven't acted in. But for this, it was always the case. I feel like being an actor, and like you mentioned, I do have this hair. I've had this hair since before Stranger Things dropped. So, you know, that character, it was a big thing where I was kind of like, oh, well, shoot, you know, it's and now obviously the mullet is very popular with the youth. So yeah, it's been strange for that trend to kind of come back around where we were kind of ahead of it. But obviously, when you slog away to get a movie out into the world, it takes time. And obviously, through a global pandemic in the middle of it, ours was just the whole thing was perpetuated even longer. So, you know, I hopefully people won't look at this and say, oh, another 80s movie. It's like, well, in order for it to come out and to come out properly, it just took time and money. And obviously, like I mentioned, throw in COVID, and it just was, it's been a long time coming.
One of the things about Toronto is that it's always known for being a very diverse city, very multicultural city, and that's reflected in the film, whether it's you and I think the other lead character, or you see
Ruben.
Fang,
Yep.
yeah, Ruben, or Fang, or even the Jews, the Jewish gangsters that you see at one point. How conscious are you as a filmmaker of sort of that type of conversations that are happening right now in terms of diversity and representation on film, especially when it's in a city such as Toronto?
I think I'm conscious of it, but I think what works with this film is that it's not like in your face contrived. It just is. Like you mentioned, I think
Right.
it's an accurate representation of Toronto and, you know, the people involved in this movie. I think you can tell when there's, you know, that is so blatant or it's maybe tokenism or whatever, whereas this, it just is, you know, in the same way that this is, you know, this movie is 100% CanCon. But it's like, how could it not be? We shot it in
Right.
Canada. We are Canadians. We don't have to try to make it something. It just is.
There's a line that I love right at the beginning where you're talking with Marcy and she says contemporary neo-formalism, which is very academic, but maybe to others can sounds a little bit like I don't know what the hell she's talking about. I'm wondering if that was sort of like a purposely pretentious thing to kind of maybe spoof academics and sort of this neo-hipster movement that we're seeing a little bit.
Definitely. It definitely was tongue in cheek. And I think at the beginning of the film, you know, obviously my character, he's a philosophy professor, and his girlfriend Marnie, she is also a teacher at the university. So I definitely wanted to make it heavily jargon at the beginning of what they're talking about. Like you said, they are academics, pseudo intellectuals, if you will, but I wanted that to be a huge contrast from what happens later. So at the beginning, it's almost, you know, it's slow, it's boring, and that's in the editing, that's in the music. That was all very intentional. So then when he starts drinking and they start getting back into the old lifestyle, it gradually becomes more exciting and you get less of that kind of drawl intellectualism. So that was definitely on purpose, yes.
We hear this term beer goggles, and I think your character maybe arguably becomes smarter, or harnesses his knowledge in a different way after he's been drinking. Have you thought about how and why alcohol can affect our actions like that, in sort of almost like this functional high?
Of course. I mean, that's mentioned in, you know, directly in the script, liquid courage. I think with his character, because he's low key, you know, OCD, when he's able to imbibe alcohol, he loses his inhibitions. He's able to act impulsively. And that's just how, you know, it works. When people loosen up, they break the ice with any drugs, really. I mean, obviously in moderation, but I think for this character, he is so at the mercy of being careful and being prudent his whole life that when he does let loose a little bit, that's when there's a happy medium where he has this knowledge or these skills, what have you. But it's only when through alcohol or getting slightly inebriated is he able to take control, which sounds kind of odd. It sounds the opposite, but it was kind of like a Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde type thing where it's obviously a trope, but I tried to lean into it tastefully where it's kind of believable, where it's like he's not ridiculously sloshed or anything like that. It's similar to how in different eras, like if you look at Mad Men, they're constantly just half in the bag.
There's a great conversation between your character and Ruben where he calls Ruben an enabler, and it does strike me that maybe Ruben's a bit of a gaslighter. The idea to have the character call him out in the script in this sort of day and age of accountability and stuff like that. How conscious of a decision was that given the times we are living in?
Well, it's funny because again, the script was written 5 years ago, so not as pertinent as you might think. It definitely was just like, I think everyone knows friends who just take it too far. Perpetually, they take it too far, take it too far. And I think this character, the Leslie character, realizes like, hey, I can't keep up with you. And Ruben knows that. Ruben knows the whole time. Like, if I get him liquored up, he'll kind of do whatever I want. And so in that way, he enables that behavior. He encourages that behavior. So that's what that's about in terms of being like, you enable me to be careless, which is what Ruben banks on him to do.
Out of all the scenes that you shot, was there a moment of yours that's a favorite?
Moment of mine, that's a favorite. There's a lot of nice kind of it was important that, when you have an 80s movie, obviously there are tropes and there are classic things, but I think how those movies are remembered is they have se several kind of signature moments where it's like, oh, okay, this happened, this movie, this happened, this movie. I do really like the driving in the Porsche going to the tournament. I think the music there, the score does a lot of the heavy lifting. Matthew Chalmers, our composer, knocked it out of the park in terms of me giving him references and us going back and forth on what it should sound like. That I think is the closest it comes to a bona fide 80s movie, and that's referencing Michael Mann, Miami Vice. That's referencing Thief, another Michael Mann movie, where it's a lot of nighttime imagery of the city, of the characters. Not much is spoken, and the music really brings you to that era. So I think for those couple minutes there, where they're driving and they're kind of like, there's a sense of impending doom, or like the climax. That for me is like a sweet spot because it's cool to watch, and yeah, I edited the movie, but when you sit there and watch people watch it in a theater, a couple hundred people, surround sound, nice speakers, just taking in the music, where it's like paired nicely, I think that is like doesn't happen in movies much anymore. So that one for me really sticks out.
Is there something that you want audiences to take away from this film when they watch it?
For sure. What do you think? Like, what was your primary takeaway?
Well, I think know who your friends are, I think is one that I got, especially because we see or like know who the most important people in your life are, because we see that with Leslie and Ruben, but then also Ruben's whole trying to avenge Saul as well. I think is important. Know your limits, could be another one. But as an artist myself, I always try not to read into things too much, because then you just maybe enjoy it less.
Yeah, no, I agree. If you're looking to dissect something, you aren't living really in the moment, and you're always kind of unraveling with, oh, why is this here? Why is this here? I think to answer that question, it would be less so kind of like plot points, but it would be more so tonally, where the way we package the film up, you can take it either at face value from A to B, like, wow, this is an 80s movie, or you can kind of realize that it is very meta. Because it's a we're trying to emulate a specific genre that now doesn't really exist. Because we know about it, revisionists, we can look back and we can kind of take notes from it. So I think the main point was like, not only can this exist as an 80s movie, but if you want to unpackage it, you can see that like it's kind of a Trojan horse. Like it's you can take it seriously, but also it's pretty ridiculous. So tonally, like I mentioned, the original short film was very low-hanging fruit, funny parody stuff, whereas this was like, I didn't write a ton of jokes, a ton of zingers, but circumstantially and within the context, like the tournament, for example, I don't want to give spoilers, but it's like you kind of can get away with it based on the tone and the conviction that if a contemporary movie had that today, you'd be like, oh, this is a farce. This is too absurdist. It's whatever. So I think for me, it was important to kind of like Trojan horse this way in, where it's like, as it goes, it gets more and more ridiculous, but the audience doesn't know until they find out the same as the characters.
Well, the film is going in and it will be out on VOD and digital on December the 19th. Evan Reese, thanks so much for jumping on today.
Thanks for having me, Dan. Pleasure.
Alrighty, take care.
Bye.
That was my conversation with Evan Reese. His film Going In is available video on demand on December the 19th. That does it for me today, and that does it for me this year. My thanks to Evan, Sonia, and everybody who has come on the show this year, and everybody who has listened, joined, and continue to listen. Thanks for tuning in. Have a happy holidays, happy new year, and we'll see you in 2024. Bye for now.